To hear arguments in Mid-Atlantic Capital.
Good morning. May it please the court and opposing counsel. My name is Andy Stanton from Jones Day here on behalf of appellant Mid-Atlantic Capital Corporation. This case presents an issue of first impression for this court, and that is whether Section 11A of the Federal Arbitration Act constrains a district court to review only the four corners of an arbitration award document itself when determining whether there has been an evident material miscalculation of figures in that award. And the district court below found that the final damages award in the arbitration at issue was quote unquote disturbing. He found that it included a double recovery of the appellee's lost initial investment. And then he went on to hold that notwithstanding that fact, he was not able to rectify it because Section 11A confines the district court's review to quote unquote the face of the award. Now, that language, the face of the award, is a phrase that doesn't appear in the statute, doesn't come from any case law in this circuit, and in fact has its origins in a Southern District of New York opinion applying the New York State CPLR.
Which is, I guess, if we dig down deep enough, it's the source. New York arbitration law is the source of our arbitration rules. So doesn't that carry some weight, this historic interpretation of that phrase, and that we look only for errors, we only look as deep as the face of the award?
Your Honor, it's a good question, and yes, acknowledging that the New York rules historically provide source material for the Federal Arbitration Act, there are two points to make in response to your question. The first is that even the quotation from that Southern District New York case has been bastardized and shortened. So the circuit court opinion in Apex, which was cited by the district court, has a quotation from this Southern District case, which is called Howe, where it has an ellipsis in the quotation. And the ellipsis is important because the full content of what the court in Howe said was that arbitration awards won't be changed unless there is an error on the face of the award or a miscalculation can be clearly inferred. That portion of the quote from the Southern District opinion was not included in the Apex Court's.
The error can be inferred part?
Yes, or can be clearly inferred. And so the analysis starts as it has to start with the language of the statute itself, and you know, the language is very clear. It says district courts may make an order modifying or correcting the award where there was an evident material miscalculation of figures. This phrase does not impose a quantitative limitation on what a district court may look at. It is a qualitative standard. Evident means clear. Material is a well-known and often used term of art in law, and I would posit to the court that that word in and of itself renders the proposition that review is confined to the award document nonsensical, because how will a court ever know, even if a miscalculation is apparent on the face of an award document itself, something akin to 2 + 2 = 5, how will a court determine if that's material? And the answer is, maybe if the award coincidentally happens to provide enough information, such a determination could be made, but maybe not. And there is no basis in logic or the language of the statute to say when a properly submitted record is before a district court, as was the case here, and from that record, which district courts are highly competent to review, that's what they do. From that record, the district court can determine there has been a clear miscalculation, There is no basis in the language of the statute to say, however, district court, you can't fix it.
Even if you go beyond the face of the award here, why is it so readily apparent that you'll meet the statutory standard? I mean, even the district court alluded to the fact that it wasn't clear how you would compute the assignment that had taken place in this case, and so that was an issue. The fact that Mr. Wellman didn't receive an individual initial investment loss in the award, how that all factors into this equation. Those are ambiguities that suggest you wouldn't meet the statutory standard anyway.
Respectfully, Judge Holmes, I disagree for two reasons.
I would assume as much, but tell me the two reasons, please.
And I think there are really two parts to the answer to your question. The first is, and it goes to this court's standard of review. The trial judge made a factual finding that there was a double recovery. He also went on to say, it's not clear how I would resolve this issue if I had the authority to do so, which I don't, because there was a reassignment requirement, and I would have to hold a hearing. Now, Section 11A doesn't say district courts can't hold hearings in order to make determinations as to whether miscalculations are evident or to resolve them.
How is that consistent with the incredibly deferential standard of review that you have as it relates to arbitration awards? When you're holding hearings and I presumably which could include taking testimony, I mean, you are digging into the weeds of a decision that in a way that suggests a NOVA review. It doesn't suggest this extremely deferential standard that you have. So I don't know. Number one, even if we were to adopt the view that we go beyond the face of the award, it's not clear to me what the limiting principle is. And you are, giving me Exhibit A of why it isn't clear what the limiting principle is.
Well, I think there's a very clear limiting principle, Judge, and that limiting principle is the district court is bound to review the record. Okay, so the district court, and respectfully, case law from the 11th Circuit upheld a district court's modification of an award for a material miscalculation where the entire proposition was ascertained from outside of the arbitration record, both the mistake itself and how to fix it. And that's the Transnitro decision. And the court there pointed to the last line of Section 11, which is important statutory language. And I want to just make sure I quote it correctly. The last line of Section 11, the order may modify and correct the award so as to affect the intent thereof and promote justice between the parties.
And in the drive a Mack truck through that, and that would essentially eviscerate the deferential standard if you were to give that its full range.
And I don't necessarily disagree with you, Judge, but I do think what we're advocating for is far short of what was endorsed in Transnitro and is much more akin to what happened in the Elger case. All we're saying is, first of all, the trial court's ruling that Section 11A does not permit a district court to review anything other than the award document itself, and therefore nothing more can be done, that is an erroneous interpretation of the statute. So that interpretation
is... But we don't have any case in our circuit that says that. Because you said when you started, this is a case of first impression.
That's correct, Judge.
And we have an unpublished case, right, that says that you don't go beyond the face of the document.
You have an unpublished decision in the Newcomb case, but Judge, I would say if you read that case carefully, there's not an analysis of the statutory language, and there's not an analysis at all of the question, what is the corpus of information that a trial court can properly consider in order to determine whether there has been an evident miscalculation of figures?
Regrettably, when I look at Elliger and when I look at Apex Plumbing, neither one of them has a fulsome analysis of justifying why they're doing what they're doing.
I agree 100%, Judge. I don't think there is a case. Not only is this a case of first impression for you, I think it's a fair reading of the case law that's out there, that it's an issue of first impression, period. None of these decisions analyze the text of the statute and speak about what is it that a district court can look at. To your question, which I want to answer, Judge Holmes, again, evident material miscalculation is a qualitative standard. You're saying it's got to be clear, it's got to matter, and it has to be a math mistake. It doesn't say, what am I allowed to look at in order to determine it? So when you review a trial court for clear error, if a district court in a summary judgment opinion said, I find that the car was red, but there is a stipulation, a pretrial stipulation, where the parties stipulate that the car was blue, no one would say, well, it's broadening the standard of review to permit an appellate court to look at that stipulation in order to ascertain whether the error was clear.
I guess it depends on whether the appellate court's reviewing an arbitration award or a lower federal court.
I agree, Your Honor. It's only an analogy that I'm making. But
I mean, we have very, very narrow review authority here.
There's no doubt. However, it's not non-existent, as the court in Elger said. Let's not confuse narrow with non-existent. It's narrow because the mistake has to be clear. It can only be a math error. If it goes to the merits, you can't fix it, and it has to be material. But why does it serve the purpose of furthering a narrow standard of review to tell a district court, you can't consider the arbitration record in making that determination? Let me just give you one last hypothetical. You have two awards, okay? Assume hypothetical worlds where there are two awards. Award A says damages are two for a total of five. Miscalculation, it's evident on the face of the award. Award B says damages are five, but the same mistake was made. And posit further that in the second scenario, if you just looked at the arbitration record, about which there's no dispute, you could figure it out. What purpose does it serve, even with respect to the standard of review, to say you can fix the first one but not the second one? It's the same mistake.
The purpose that it serves is your hypothetical posits the easy case. And the rule that we adopt here is not going to say flashing lights. We're only doing the easy case, as if this were an easy case, and it's not clear to me that it is. But, I mean, the question is, what then becomes, I mean, I just have a hard time seeing what the limiting principle becomes in this sort of, you say it's the record, you say it's got to be evident, yes, but come on. I mean, the way, you can dig real deep to determine what is supposedly evident, and at that point, you're overruling the bargain that the parties made to take this path.
Respectfully, Judge, I disagree. I think... Again, evident just means it has to be clear. The limiting principle is the trial judge is constrained to review the record of the arbitration proceedings. If it wasn't in the record, you can't rely on it. And we're not advocating that the judge rely on it.
Don't we have a problem here, too, that this whole issue of what is the correct number was not an issue that your client raised in arbitration?
No, we don't.
The focus there was on statute of limitations.
Yeah, we don't have that issue, Judge, because the reality is, yeah, our client...
So it's fair game now to talk about it?
Our client didn't put on a damages expert, but of course our client...
Or even challenge the damages that were asserted.
Well, our client did, in fact, cross-examine the damages expert, but importantly, and I would urge the court to review the record with respect to the damages case that was put on by the appellees, and if you review our briefing, what we're telling you is, the mistake that was made, the miscalculation, is based on their expert's own math.
So there you are. You stand up and you say, wait a minute, let's walk through this math. That's the responsibility of your client.
But the mistake wasn't made until the award was issued. Their expert did not advocate.
You have to help the arbitrator to know what the correct math is, don't you?
No, Judge. I mean, their damages case was either you could award this or you could award that.
Yes.
And they awarded both. We would have no way to predict whether we had an expert or not. Hey, listen, panel, whatever you do, make sure you don't give them a double recovery. That mistake didn't happen until the award was issued. Just very quickly, because I want to reserve a little time for rebuttal, the standard of review that you're operating under now, I think, is clear error as to factual findings and de novo as to legal determinations. And my position would be the trial court's view of how to interpret the text of 11A is to be reviewed de novo, and it's wrong. And the trial court's factual finding that this award included a double recovery should be reviewed for clear error. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Richard Fosher on behalf of appellees and cross appellants Beverly Bien and Harvey Wellman. MECC is essentially complaining that it's not fair for a district court in reviewing an arbitration award, which the court noted is an extremely narrow review, to simply focus on the face of the award when considering a motion to vacate relating to a miscalculation of figures in the award. And the reason that MACC is doing this, obviously, is because this particular award does not contain an explained decision. And in fact, MACC noted that you're only going to have this type of review when by random chance the arbitrators show their work in the award itself. The problem with this complaint that MACC is making is that it knew full well before this arbitration process started that the award was not going to contain an explained decision.
I take it the parties can negotiate to get an explained decision.
Exactly. That was going to be my next point, is that MACC could have drafted an arbitration clause which required the arbitrators to provide an explained decision to the parties in the award. It didn't do that. Additionally, within the parties' agreement, under the FINRA code, which is incorporated into the agreement, the parties have the opportunity to ask the panel for an explained decision. MACC didn't do that either. So, again, the parties can...
You mean during the course of the proceeding, the arbitration, they can ask, you know, when you render your decision, give an explained decision?
Correct.
Okay.
And it did not do that. So this fairness argument really doesn't hold a lot of water here. But specifically, as it gets as it relates to MACC's appeal and why it should be denied, the parties' agreement also had a specific provision which enabled the party to address computational errors with the panel after the award is issued. And that provision, as the court is likely aware, provided 10 days after service of the award to address narrow topics such as computational errors. It's undisputed that MACC did not make any submissions to the court, to the panel. And that clearly results as waiver. The case law is clear.
Well, the cases that you cite on that are all cases where the party didn't take advantage of an opportunity during the arbitration to correct and ask for correction of an error that was apparent during the arbitration. So this case is a little different than the cases that you've cited, at least as I view them.
I agree. And this is, I think the appropriate way to look at it would be what the parties had the right to do during the arbitration process. Of course, this is an unusual situation where you're dealing with alleged computational errors in the award. But the point is that the panel is still there. The parties can go to the panel.
Can they go now? I mean, under Rule 12905, I mean, can you still go in and say we think there's a that the initial investment loss has been counted twice in your award? Can you clarify?
No, it can only be done for a period of 10 days after service of the award. So the point is when the case law, the point to the case law, I think, is that if a party could have raised an issue or an argument with the arbitrators and it fails to do that, then the issue is waived. It's similar to an argument or an issue being raised with the district court. If the party, the litigant, cannot come to the Court of Appeals and raise this argument for the very first time. So it had the opportunity to do it during the arbitration process. It didn't do it, and as a result, it waives this argument that it's making now. In addition to that, the party's arbitration agreement noted that all controversies were going to be submitted to the arbitration panel. Here you have MACC essentially arguing, well, even though we said all controversies were going to be submitted to the FINRA arbitration process, on this particular one, we just decided that we wanted to submit it to the district court as opposed to the panel. That's wrong.
Let me ask you this. Is there a controversy? I mean, both parties seem to be in agreement that there's double counting here. Is that, do you have some theory for how this could not be a double counting of the investment loss?
Well, yes, because I think the award has to be viewed as a whole. Just to be clear, the appellee's position is not that there is that there was double counting. Because the award has to be viewed as a whole, and of course you have to consider the assignments, as the district court noted, it's kind of like it's not that clear. Now, the reason that it's not double counting is because not only do you have to factor in the assignments, but the calculations that were submitted to the panel through the claimant's experts, Bien and Wellman, never factored in the assignment in submitting those calculations. So it makes it much more difficult. But I'd also like to note that what we're dealing with here...
The assignment of what? What are you...
Sure, I'm sorry. The part of the award, the arbitration panel required that the appellees, who were the injured party, had to sign their ownership of the two securities that they owned.
Okay.
Those securities had value. I think the reason that the panel did it this way is because they were highly illiquid investments that essentially didn't trade on exchanges. There was a dispute over.
So you're saying because we have that part, that those securities involved in this award, that sort of causes the actual award amount to be more in play? That is, there's more give in it?
I think that's a fair way to describe it. If it hadn't included the assignments, then yes, it would be more difficult. But
there's no pegged value to the assignments.
Right. They're very illiquid securities, exactly. They didn't trade on exchanges. The claimants had to come in and make a guesstimate as to what they were valued at based on the secondary market.
But your experts said they were worth $82,784.
That I won't dispute that.
Okay. Now, so even if you were to back that out, it's still obvious that you had a windfall of over $200,000, at least as I do the math.
The issue, though, for the panel was it didn't have to rely on the claimant's expert for determining the valuation of the securities. MACC was arguing that these were still good securities, that they were valued higher than that, obviously, because they wanted the damages to be lower, naturally. But I think it's important to also point out that the district court correctly noted that what we're dealing with here is really not even a math issue. It's really a legal issue, the district court noted, because the arbitrators, they didn't have calculators where they were coming up with these numbers or doing shorthand math. What they did is they picked the numbers that were presented to them based on the various accounts that Bien and Wellman had, individual accounts, joint accounts. And so they took those numbers and they placed them into the award. There was no math involved. So really what MACC is complaining about here is that it feels that the arbitration panel didn't understand the correct legal manner by which to award compensatory damages to an injured party in the context of a securities fraud case. And I think the district court got that right. And I think the reason that MACC, of course, is arguing more in terms of math as opposed to this was a legal error is because, as we all know, legal error is not a ground to vacate or modify an award. I also like to talk a little bit more about another waiver issue that MACC has with this statutory construction argument. If the court has the opportunity to go back and look at the pleadings in the case before the district court, the court will see that nowhere in the opening brief or the reply or even oral argument did MACC make this argument about statutory construction and antecedent phrases and things of that nature. And of course, as we all know, you don't get to bring up brand new arguments on appeal. In fact, if the court goes back and looks at those pleadings, and that's what these motions to vacate are based on, the pleadings, it didn't really even talk about this face of the award argument. It's kind of jumping to, first it was the panel exceeded its powers, and then there was manifest disregard of the law. And now it's moved on to, it shouldn't be just on the face of the award. So again, there's many waiver problems. So if the court were to excuse all of these waivers, look at this as a math issue and not a legal error, which would be, you know, contrary to how the district court viewed it, and actually went to this issue of the face of the award, in the research that my firm did, it seemed as though every single court that talked about the face of the award adopted that position. The Elger case that MACC is talking about, it appears that the parties never even discussed whether the court should look beyond the face of the award, and the court's opinion certainly doesn't talk about the face of the award. I would submit to the court that leaving it on this type of review is not only supported by other circuits, but that standard is entirely consistent with the extremely well-settled principle of very limited review of arbitration awards and deference to the arbitrators, because otherwise you're basically opening up arbitrations. They don't end the litigation. It makes it so easy for parties to then, well, I'm going to come in because there was a miscalculation of figures. And if you don't make it in the award, on the face of the award, you could come in and challenge all types of things. You could challenge the claimant's expert made a miscalculation. We need to come in and have the district court vacate this award so that but it's, as the court noted, the time to be doing that is during the arbitration hearing. MACC can't just sit back and not explain these issues to the panel and hope that, and then just come in later and drag on this litigation, which has been going on now for 4+ years.
Do you want to talk about your issues on cross-appeal?
Yes, I'm sorry. On the cross-appeal, there are three issues, and I'm going to have to move through those quickly, obviously. The party's agreement states very clearly that if a party, losing party, files a motion to vacate, which is denied, the award shall accrue interest from the date of the award. So the district court only gave interest on the compensatory components of the award and not the attorney's fees and costs awards that were given. And as noted in the pleadings, that's a very specific provision. The other one, subsection 3, which talks about as specified by the panel, is more of a catch-all type of provision which should not be applied here. And awarding interest is not only consistent with the award, but it's consistent with the principle that MACC should not benefit from the time value of this money. It's not disputing that it has to pay my clients the attorney's fees and costs portions of the award. Why should it get the time value of that money and my clients not have the time value of that money, especially when the award specifically states that the award shall accrue interest when a losing party, when a party files a motion to vacate, which is subsequently denied. Regarding post-judgment interest, as I noted in the pleadings, I believe that should be at 8% as opposed to the federal rate of 2.1%. And the reason for that is the parties agreed, even in the submissions that both parties made to the district court, both parties agreed that the post-judgment interest rate should be 8%. In addition to that, the contract says that it should be the state legal rate, which is Colorado's 8%. Essentially, what's happening is by changing it to the federal rate, the district court modified the award. The arbitration panel said 8%. Until it's paid in full. To change it to 2.1% modifies the award, and I don't think that the court wants to do that. Finally, with regard to the assignment, I believe the district court erred because the language in the award stated that they're to assign their ownership of.
But have these securities been sold? And isn't that the problem today?
Well,
so now you're just talking about the value or some other way to compensate you.
Right. Well, what happened is there was a distribution, which ultimately was a liquidating distribution.
Oh.
So what the district court added to the panel's order was that in addition to transferring the ownership of the securities, they also had to transfer any dividends, distributions, and interest. And what we're asking for is obviously that the judgment reflect the plain language.
Because the option would be, if you just said transfer the securities, that's nothing. There's nothing left.
That's true. At this point,
so all you have is the past value, which is the accrual of the distributions.
Correct. And I agree. It may seem unfair, but again, I think the judgment should reflect what the award says, not additional phrases that the district court added to the judgment.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
A waiver. First, the FINRA rule applies when awards are final. You may submit a calculation error to the director of FINRA, who may submit it to the panel, who may decline to hear it. We filed a motion to vacate the award and in the alternative to modify it. There's no FINRA rule that allows you to seek vacator. And as Your Honor noted, the case law is not on all fours. The only case that comes close to being like this one is a trial court opinion that was vacated. So there's no waiver based upon the failure to follow a permissive FINRA rule that didn't toll the time to pay.
When rules say you may, I mean, that's another way of letting people know this is a remedy that's available to you, and you chose not to take advantage of that remedy by asking the arbitration panel to clarify its own award.
Correct, Your Honor, because as we stand here today, the relief that was sought at the district court has been pared down to a single sub-issue out of three broader issues that were presented in the initial motion to vacate, 90% of which cannot be presented to the FINRA panel pursuant to that rule. And so we were going to be in district court anyway. And there's nothing in the terms of the FAA that would say you have to seek permissive calculation fixes from an arbitration panel before you proceed under Section 11A. And the cases don't support that proposition.
Well, certainly not jurisdictional, but, you know, one body might be able to help you and another body might have their hands tied, right? I mean,
We had a serious question, and I didn't try the underlying case, but there was a serious question as to whether to raise the bias of the panel itself as a ground for vacating the award. And it simply was not viewed as a plausible path, given that there was only a very narrow possible thing that panel could have considered under the FINRA rule and a much broader argument to be made under the FAA. Really quickly.
You're out of time. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Our next case.